H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 3. A Search and an Evocation. 2. Young Ward came home in a state of pleasant excitement and spent the following Saturday in a long and exhaustive study of the house in Olney Court. The place, now crumbling with age, had never been a mansion, but was a modest 2.5-story wooden townhouse of the familiar Providence colonial type, with plain peaked roof, large central chimney, and artistically carved doorway with rayed fanlight, triangular pediment, and trim Doric pilasters. It had suffered but little alteration externally, and Ward felt he was gazing on something very close to the sinister matters of his quest. The present Negro inhabitants were known to him, and he was very courteously shown about the interior by old Asa and his stout wife Hannah. Here there was more change than the outside indicated, and Ward saw with regret that fully half of the fine scroll and urn overmantels and shell-carved cupboard linings were gone, whilst much of the fine wainscoting and Belection molding was marked, hacked, and gouged, or covered up altogether with cheap wallpaper. In general, the survey did not yield as much as Ward had somehow expected, but it was at least exciting to stand within the ancestral walls which had housed such a man of horror as Joseph Curwen. He saw with a thrill that a monogram had been very carefully effaced from the ancient brass knocker. From then until after the close of school, Ward spent his time on the photostatic copy of the Hutchinson cipher and the accumulation of local Curwen data. The former still proved unyielding, but of the latter he obtained so much and so many clues to similar data elsewhere that he was ready by July to make a trip to New London and New York to consult old letters whose presence in those places was indicated. This trip was very fruitful, for it brought him the Finner letters with their terrible description of the Pawtuxet farmhouse raid, and the Nightingale Talbot letters in which he learned of the portrait painted on a panel of the Curwen Library. This matter of the portrait interested him particularly, since he would have given much to know just what Joseph Curwen looked like, and he decided to make a second search of the house in Olney Court to see if there might not be some trace of the ancient features beneath peeling coats of later paint or layers of moldy wallpaper. Early in August that search took place, and Ward went carefully over the walls of every room sizable enough to have been by any possibility the library of the evil builder. He paid especial attention to the large panels of such overmantels as still remained, and was keenly excited after about an hour, when on a broad area above the fireplace in a spacious ground floor room he became certain that the surface brought out by the peeling of several coats of paint was sensibly darker than any ordinary interior paint or the wood beneath it was likely to have been. A few more careful tests with a thin knife, and he knew that he had come upon an oil portrait of great extent. With truly scholarly restraint, the youth did not risk the damage which an immediate attempt to uncover the hidden picture with a knife might have done, but just retired from the scene of his discovery to enlist expert help. In 3 days, he returned with an artist of long experience, Mr. Walter C. Dwight, whose studio is near the foot of College Hill, and that accomplished restorer of painting set to work at once with proper methods and chemical substances. Old Asa and his wife were duly excited over their strange visitors, and were properly reimbursed for this invasion of their domestic hearth. As day by day the work of restoration progressed, Charles Ward looked on with growing interest at the lines and shades gradually unveiled after their long oblivion. Dwight had begun at the bottom, hence, since the picture was a 3/4-length one, the face did not come out for some time. It was meanwhile seen that the subject was a spare, well-shaped man with dark blue coat, embroidered waistcoat, black satin small clothes, and white silk stockings, seated in a carved chair against the background of a window with wharves and ships beyond. When the head came out, it was observed to bear a neat Albemarle wig, and to possess a thin, calm, undistinguished face which seemed somehow familiar to both Ward and the artist. Only at the very last, though, did the restorer and his client begin to gasp with astonishment at the details of that lean, pallid visage, and to recognize with a touch of awe the dramatic trick which heredity had played. For it took the final bath of oil and the final stroke of the delicate scraper to bring out fully the expression which centuries had hidden, and to confront the bewildered Charles Dexter Ward, dweller in the past, with his own living features and the countenance of his horrible great-great-great-grandfather. Ward brought his parents to see the marvel he had uncovered, and his father at once determined to purchase the picture despite its execution on stationary paneling. The resemblance to the boy, despite an appearance of rather greater age, was marvelous, and it could be seen that through some trick of atavism, the physical contours of Joseph Kerwin had found precise duplication after a century and a half. Mrs. Ward's resemblance to her ancestor was not at all marked, though she could recall relatives who had some of the facial characteristics shared by her son and by the bygone Kerwin. She did not relish the discovery, and told her husband that he had better burn the picture instead of bringing it home. There was, she averred, something unwholesome about it, not only intrinsically, but in its very resemblance to Charles. Mr. Ward, however, was a practical man of power and affairs, a cotton manufacturer with extensive mills at River Point in the Pawtuxet Valley, and not one to listen to feminine scruples. The picture impressed him mightily with its likeness to his son, and he believed the boy deserved it as a present. In this opinion, it is needless to say, Charles most heartily concurred, and a few days later Mr. Ward located the owner of the house, a small rodent-featured person with a guttural accent, and obtained the whole mantle and overmantle bearing the picture at a curtly fixed price which cut short the impending torrent of unctuous haggling. It now remained to take off the paneling and remove it to the Ward home, where provisions were made for its thorough restoration and installation with an electric mock fireplace in Charles's third-floor study or library. To Charles was left the task of superintending this removal, and on the 28th of August he accompanied two expert workmen from the Crooker decorating firm to the house in Olney Court, where the mantle and portrait-bearing overmantle were detached with great care and precision for transportation in the company's motor truck. There was left a space of exposed brickwork marking the chimney's course, and in this young Ward observed a cubicle recess about a foot square, which must have lain directly behind the head of the portrait. Curious as to what such a space might mean or contain, the youth approached and looked within, finding beneath the deep coatings of dust and soot some loose yellowed papers, a crude, thick copybook, and a few moldering textile shreds which may have formed the ribbon binding the rest together. Blowing away the bulk of the dirt and cinders, he took up the book and looked at the bold inscription on its cover. It was in a hand which he had learned to recognize at the Essex Institute, and proclaimed the volume as the
Journal and Notes of Joseph Kerwin, Gentleman of Providence Plantations, late of Salem.
Excited beyond measure by his discovery, Ward showed the book to the two curious workmen beside him. Their testimony is absolute as to the nature and genuineness of the finding, and Dr. Willett relies on them to help establish his theory that the youth was not mad when he began his major eccentricities. All the other papers were likewise in Kerwin's handwriting, and one of them seemed especially pretentious because of its inscription,
To him who shall come after, and how he may get beyond time in these spheres.
Another was in a cipher, the same, Ward hoped, as the Hutchinson cipher which had hitherto baffled him. A third, and here the searcher rejoiced, seemed to be a key to the cipher, whilst the fourth and fifth were addressed respectively to
Edward Hutchinson, Armiger,
and
Jedediah Orne, Esquire, or their heir or heirs, or those representing them.
The sixth and last was inscribed
Joseph Kerwin, his life and travels between the years 1678 and 1687, of whither he voyaged, where he stayed, whom he saw, and what he learnt.